Parshas Vayetze is largely concerned with sheep and shepherds. The story begins, Yaakov gets to Haran, running from Esav. He's at the well, and he sees that the shepherds are coming with various flocks. He interrogates them about the procedures for watering. He asks, where can he find Lavan? They tell him, here's Rachel, she's coming in with sheep. Yaakov follows Rachel back to Lavan. He begins to work for Lavan. He's working with sheep, apparently. He works 7 years for Rachel, 7 years for Leah. Then after he's been working with sheep for 14 years, Yaakov says he's ready to go. They say, do some more work with the sheep, take care of the sheep some more, and I'll give you sheep. And then they have an elaborate arrangement with Yaakov taking a percentage of the sheep, an elaborate system or changes of rules about colored sheep and brown sheep and speckled sheep and spotted sheep, so on and so forth. Then when Yaakov eventually makes a run for it, he takes the sheep along, Lavan chases him and said, you took my daughters, you took my sheep, so on. The story goes on. The beginning of Parshas Vayishlach is also actually concerned with sheep. The sheep are only a small part of the gift that Yaakov sends to his brother Esav, but sheep are there too. Parshas Vayeshev, the entire narrative of going down to Egypt, begins with sheep. It says that Yaakov's sons are tending the sheep, and he sends Yosef to go see how they're doing. They go down to Mitzrayim. When Yosef's brothers eventually make it down to Mitzrayim, Yosef instructs them, Paro's going to ask you, what do you do for a living? Tell them that you're shepherds and you work with sheep, then he'll give you land appropriate for sheep. Pretty much the rest of Sefer Bereishis is sheep are never far from the central narrative. Parsha Shmos 2, the story begins Moshe Rabbeinu, after he strikes down the Mitzri and he runs to Midian, he finds the daughters of Yisro are watering sheep. He goes back to, he marries Tzipora. He spends some time with his father-in-law Yisro again, tending the sheep in the Midbar, where he has the vision of the burning bush and so on. A lot of sheep. Sheep go throughout Tanakh. Sheep and shepherds are a major motif throughout Tanakh. Psalm 23, Mizmar LeDavid, Hashem Roi Lo Echzer. I think I read one article I was reading about sheep in the Bible said this is the most beloved, most popular chapter in the whole Bible is about an elaborate metaphor of God as our shepherd. On the back, I have a brief reference to the Gospel of John. We'll touch on that a little more soon. Also, apparently, a famous discussion of sheep as a religious theme, sheep and shepherds. So, in general, the commentators pick up on this, the Midrashim, the medieval commentators pick up on this point that, specifically, that many great men of Israel, eventual leaders, started their careers tending sheep. We find, Yaakov Avinu, the patriarch, is very busy with sheep. We find King David. It says that when Shmuel goes to God's instructions to go raise him to the monarchy, he's out there tending the sheep. And Moshe Rabbeinu, of course, as we mentioned earlier, Moshe Rabbeinu is out there with the sheep when he has the iconic vision of the burning bush and is sent to go take the Jews out of Egypt. So the Medrash and the Rishonim already pick up on this. What is so significant about shepherding? There are various answers given. In paragraph 1, Rabbeinu Bachya, he gives, I think, what I think are some of the typical explanations we often find. He talks about how the fellowship of humans is often not conducive to spiritual growth. There's a lot of dissension and machlokas and rechilas and lashon hara. In general, it's distracting the cares and toil of the temporal world. The business, fellowship of people, is not always the greatest thing conducive towards spirituality. His bodhidus, isolation, meditation, there's nothing there but you and nature and the sky. So I think the Kliyakar says, you can see the clear sky, you just sit there and you contemplate the stars, as Dr. Schneiderman would talk to say you need telescopes for that. But you look at the stars, it helps you reach spiritual heights, and so on and so forth. And that's one of the ideas you often find, that it's just good to stay away from people and to just be able to focus and focus internally, and you can grow spiritually and religiously just by isolation. Sometimes the life of a hermit, at least at some stage in one's religious career, can be good for one's spiritual development. That's one idea. There is another idea, which I think is better known, perhaps more popular. That is a Medrash Rabbah, a classic and beloved story, I think. The Medrash says that when Moshe Rabbeinu, in the beginning of Parashat Shmos, the Torah tells us he followed the sheep and he eventually got to the vision of the burning bush. So the Medrash says, what happened was, in more detail, was that Moshe saw a little lamb that ran off, a kid, a gedi, a lamb of some sort that ran off from the flock. Moshe chased it down. Finally, catching up to it, he saw that it was drinking from a brook. So Moshe Rabbeinu said, the poor sheep, you know, I didn't realize you're thirsty, you must be tired. So he picked up the lamb and he carried it back to the, he gave it a break. And God says, I see, Moshe, that you care about the animal sheep, you care so much about the welfare of the individual sheep, you'll make a great leader and you'll take care of Tzoni, Tzon Yisrael, you'll take care of my sheep, Israel. Same thing about King David, the Medrash says, essentially the same point, that the Medrash is inferring the language of the biblical text. It says he was at David when he was called up to the monarchy, he was at Michlaos Hatzon. So the Medrash interprets this to mean that he had an elaborate scheme for allowing the sheep to feed in different stages, because the big tough sheep can eat anything, the smaller delicate sheep can only eat the delicate grass. If they all are let out at once, and the big sheep would gobble up the delicate grass, and the poor little sheep would have nothing to eat, so he let them out in stages, he gave the little sheep the first crack at the grass, so on. So again, Akash Baruch Hu says, I see Moshe, you understand the sheep, I see David, you understand the sheep, you care about the sheep, you do what's best for each sheep. I see you'll be a great leader of my people. Now, I was always a little personally uncomfortable with this idea. It's like, you know, you read these science fiction stories where the aliens are being take over the world and they're really nice to all the humans, and then you realize to your horror that the aliens eat humans and they're raising them because when they grow up, they fatten them and they eat them. It's true, you can tend to animals, but most animal husbandry, most shepherdry is a financial proposition. The men of old were not that sentimental, Charlotte's Web and stuff, you know. Aside, they raised sheep because sheep were good to eat and because they had wool, I guess. They raised cows. Cows gave milk. They were beasts of burden. They were also slaughtered and eaten. So the point is, the shepherd's primary job, at least, is really as a fiduciary of his employer. Or if it's his own sheep, then he's trying to make money. If it's the employer's sheep, then he's out to preserve the interest of his employer. So it seemed a little bit of an odd kind of career to not exactly maybe the best metaphor I would have thought for leadership of men. I guess the Medrash understands that at the end of the day, you have a kind of dual mission. Your mission is A, to preserve the interest of your employer, but B, also to the extent that you can, as we've discussed previously, Judaism certainly believes in Tzar Balei Chaim to the extent that you can in minimizing the pain of animals and doing what you can for the animals. But in any event, a lot of the shepherding that goes on here is primarily, obviously, it's not about tikkun olam and being good to the sheep, it's primarily about serving the financial interests of your employer. And returning to our Parsha, Parshas Vayetze, that is indeed, Yaakov has this magnificent outburst to Lavan when Lavan accuses him basely, meanly, of having cheated him and of having stolen his daughters. So Yaakov has finally had enough, and Yaakov tells Lavan, he tells him, he refers to his record, look how honest he's been, I've never done anything, and Yaakov says, look at my record, he says, Zeh Esrim Shana Anochi Imach, I've been with you for 20 years, 7 years for Rachel, 7 years for Leah, 6 years in the profit-sharing arrangement of the sheep. I've been with you for 20 years. Rechelecha v'izecha lo shikelu. I haven't passed off miscarriages to you. They've had the fertility they're supposed to have. Eilei tzon chalo achalti. I didn't eat the rams. Trefa lo hevesi eilecha. I didn't bring you any dead animals and say, sorry, I paid for it all. Anochi achatena miyadi tevakshena. Anything missing, I was accountable. I was responsible. Scrupulously honest, gnufsi yom, gnufsi laila, anything that was stolen by day or by night, I was accountable, haisi bayom, I was there with the sheep during the day, achalani chara v'karach balaila, I guess like the deserts, it's very hot during the day, it's freezing at night, I was sunburnt during the day, frostbitten at night, batidash nasi me'enai, I didn't sleep, estrim shana, again, Yaakov is outraged that Lavan dare suspect him of financial impropriety, of stealing, of failure in his responsibility to Lavan. Yaakov's point is, look at my record as a fiduciary. I have been conducting myself with sterling honesty, sterling accountability. How dare you accuse me of behaving badly? And the truth is, in the Talmud and later sources too, these comments of Yaakov are held up and are analyzed in classic Talmudic fashion as being some of the seminal rules and descriptions of what a fiduciary, someone like a shepherd, Bailey is the technical term, I think. In Talmud, we call it a shomer. Apparently, the legal term is a Bailey. I've never seen the word Bailey or bailment or anything of that sort used outside a very dry legal context. Shomer, I guess in Hebrew, we translate as guardian. But some of these halachas of how you're supposed to deal with someone else's money and what you're responsible for are actually inferred from this passage of Yaakov's declaration to Lavan, as we shall discuss. Just a little bit of background first, by way of general background. under Talmudic law, which is still pretty much practiced today, comes down through us to the Shulchan Aruch and still pretty much in force, there are three levels of Beili responsibilities. There's what we call Shomer Chinam, the unpaid guardian. There's what we call Shomer Sachar, the paid guardian. And there is Shoel, the borrower. In the middle category of Shomer Sachar, the halacha is also a socher. A renter has the same level of liability. It's a Shan L'Gemara, that's how we paskin. And additionally, the third category, that middle category is quite large. It includes the paid guardian, the renter, and more broadly, it includes professionals of various sorts, artisans, dry cleaners, people who have auto mechanics, anyone with whom you have a relationship that benefits both sides, basically, not an outright loan like a shoel, and not a favor like a shomer chinam, pretty much anything in the middle falls into that middle category. The halachas, in a nutshell, are as follows. A shomer chinam has the lowest level of responsibility. He is only liable for gross negligence, what the halacha calls pshia. You're at the airport, someone says, please wash my suitcase, I'm going to the bathroom. You say, sure, no problem. You take his suitcase, put it on your lap. Then you say, you know what, I want to go read a newspaper. You drop the suitcase on the bench. You walk off, the bomb squad comes, they detonate it. You are chayev, you have been grossly negligent. And that is shomer chinam. On the other extreme, we have the shoel, the borrower, because he's getting kol hanah shelo, because he's getting complete use of the object and paying nothing for it, he has the highest level of liability. He's chayev pretty much for anything, what the law would call strict liability, regardless of any fault, any negligence, it doesn't matter. Earthquake happens, fire, acts of God, he's pretty much responsible for everything, with a couple of narrow exceptions, which were not so narrow exceptions, but we're not going to get into them right now. And the middle category is the most complex, the trickiest. Shomer Sachar, the paid guardian, Socher, the renter, Uman, the artisan. These middle categories, the halacha is, they have in-between liability. They are responsible certainly for pshia, for gross negligence. They are also responsible for gneva v'aveda, theft and loss, which halacha considers a kind of sort of your fault. You're not really negligent, but you could have been a little more careful about it. You're chayav for that too. And as we'll see, we'll discuss soon, a broader discussion of that actually has to do with the psukim of Yaakov Avinu. So the Talmud, the passage in Bav Metzia, a key discussion goes as follows. A very central passage, number two over here, very central passage to the responsibility of the Shomer Sachar. Now, the shepherd is basically a shomer sachar, typically. Typically, he's being paid, he's a worker, he's being paid for his work, he's not being paid strictly for watching, that's part of his job. Basically, he'd be a pretty classic shomer sachar. So the Talmud has a story, has a kind of case, a fact pattern. Somebody was tending animals on the banks of Nahar Papa, a certain river. One of the animals fell in, and the first opinion of the Talmud, Rabbah's opinion, is he is potter, not liable. What could he have done? He said, that's why. What do you want him to do? Any reasonable standard of care, the Talmud fails. They fall in. Yeah, it happens sometimes. Not really your fault. So the Talmud then goes back and forth trying to decide whether this is correct or not. At one point, the Talmud says, it brings a braisa. The braisa says, Esve, what is the extent of the liability of a shomer sachar? To the extent that Yaakov Avinu said, Hayisi bayom, achalani chara v'karach balayla. Shomer has to be there all the time. He can't just say, it's nighttime, it's too hot, it's too cold. He has to be there constantly, nonstop, no exceptions. There's no limit. Shomer has to do everything humanly possible. So the Gemara says, no, an ordinary Shomer doesn't have to do that. That's only a special case, a special type of Shomer, Chazne Masa, who were specially responsible, who were paid extra for this, that they have extra liability. An ordinary Shomer would not have to do that. So the Gemara says, but Yaakov Avinu was an ordinary Shomer. He was a simple private employee. So why did he have to do that? So the Gemara said, you're right. Yaakov didn't say he had to do it. Yaakov didn't mean that he did strictly what he was responsible to do. Yaakov's entire point to Lavan was, I did more than I would have to do. I went above and beyond the call of duty. Yaakov wasn't just priding himself on having stuck to the letter of the law. Yaakov was saying, I was so scrupulous, I was so meticulous that I did more than I had to do. That's the initial position of the Talmud. That what Yaakov did, what Yaakov prided himself on being there all night and not sleeping and freezing and burning, that was all beyond the letter of the law. Now, there is a dispute, however, in subsequent poskim, whether that is normative halacha or not. Is what Yaakov did actually, as the Gemara says, beyond the letter of the law, or actually what every paid employee, what every shepherd, paid shepherd would have to do? So in the Shiltas of Rav Achai, a Gaonic work, one of the earliest, most important of the post-Talmudic works, so the Shiltas of Rav Achai says that a that he says that a shepherd must do this. He says a shepherd must remain with the property by day, by night, no exceptions, at all costs, must stay there all the time. D'hachi Ashkan b'Yaakov. He says, Yaakov did this. Yaakov said, Natris la'anach, I have guarded your sheep, yimamu v'lelia, hayisi bayom, machalani chare, v'kerach balayla. The Sheiltos rules that everything Yaakov did is nothing more than his obligation under the law. Others disagree. For example, I don't have it on the papers here, but Rav Yeshaya Berlin, not to be confused with Isaiah Berlin, but Rav Yeshaya Berlin, a noted early Achron, says no. He says that the Talmud says that Yaakov did not have to do what he did. What Yaakov did was exceptional, was beyond the letter of the law. So he says no. And Shulchan Aruch indeed does not bring this. Does not bring that a shepherd, a paid shepherd, must stay there all night and all day. That's not part of his responsibility. And the Achronim go back and forth on this point. The truth is it hinges on the conclusion of the Talmudic passage. The conclusion of the Talmud, which I skipped before, is that we paskin that in the case of the shepherd who let the animal fall into the water, we paskin the halacha is that he is liable. We say that a paid shepherd who's getting paid for his work, again, the fundamental principle is because you're getting paid, you assume a higher level of responsibility, and therefore he is chayev. The Gemara calls this level of responsibility netirusa yiserta, extra level of care. A paid shomer is obligated in this extra level of care, and therefore some achronim argue that even though the Gemara initially said that hayisi bayom machalani charev akarach balayla, being there all night and freezing and burning, is lefimashur sadin, balamaskan of the Gemara, in the conclusion of the Gemara that a shomer, a paid shomer, has this extra level of responsibility called netirusa yiserta, many achronim therefore rule that's the position of the Sheiltos, the Netziv, that in his commentary on the Sheiltos explains, that's their position, that lahalacha, as a matter of normative law, what Yaakov did is strictly required of him according to halacha. He was not doing anything more than he was required, and a shomer does have this extraordinary level of care. For Aaron Cutler, this is actually writing in a non-halacha context, it's in a Musar Shmuz he gave. For Aaron Cutler, though, takes the other position. He says that what Yaakov did with the sheep, he says Yaakov was engaged in dinim, which are not found in Chashan Mishpat, which is true, it's not found in the Shulchan Aruch and Chashan Mishpat. For example, Hayisi Bayom, Machalani Chorev, Vikarach Balayla, Batidat Shnafi Me'enai, not sleeping. He says all those things, Banhagos Ka'elu, these types of conducts, Ein Sacher Chayev, this is not something the halacha requires of an ordinary person, and therefore Yaakov was doing above and beyond the call of duty. Now, as people pointed out to me this morning when I was discussing this, it's a little tricky knowing how to apply this in a practical way. Everyone agrees, it's a very clear halacha, that these arrangements, like most contractual arrangements in Chashan Mishpat, are subject to any contract that you desire to engage in. You can stipulate, the owner and his employee can stipulate any arrangement they want, any level of liability, more than the Torah, less than the Torah, it's really up to you. And moreover, prevailing custom will commonly control. If there is a clear custom, the Talmud, for example, says with regard to employees, when does the workday start? So there's a whole Talmudic discussion. Does it start at daybreak? Does it start earlier? Does it start later? Does the traveling time come out of the employer's time, the employee's time? But the ultimate rule, the Talmud says, is Hakol Kaminika Medina, Minig Mavatal Halacha. Prevailing custom will usually control in the absence of an explicit arrangement to the contrary. So in general, these halachas are kind of defaults. They're relevant in the absence of any stipulation and any prevailing custom. But if there is a custom, that will usually control. With regard to shepherds, you would think, certainly in biblical times, where it was pretty common part of one's lifestyle, you would think that the standard arrangements for shepherds were pretty clear. What was expected, what his hours were, whether he had to stay at night, he didn't have to stay at night. You'd think these things would be pretty clear, would be established, if not by explicit contract, at least by custom. But nevertheless, the Gemara does tell us these rules in the abstract, and as a matter in the Shulchan Aruch, and as a matter of normative halacha, there's actually a dispute as to whether a shepherd is required to do everything Yaakov did, assuming he's getting paid or not. An unpaid shepherd definitely would not have to do what Yaakov did. Someone who was just doing a favor. A paid shepherd, we have a machlokas among poskim down to the later authorities with no clear resolution as to whether the paid shepherd actually had to do whatever Yaakov did or not. Now, there's another interesting point that arises from the discussion of Yaakov. That has to do with, conceptually, how do we understand the responsibilities of a shomer sachar? Halacha has the notion of an employee. An employee gets paid to perform a service. Halacha also has the notion of shomrim, of insurance, that essentially that you have liability independent of fault even. For example, we mentioned earlier the shoel, the borrower, is responsible for anything that happens, including including something that's completely out of his control, an earthquake, a hurricane, a fire. He's chayev. So when we deal with the Shomer Sachar and we say he's not chayev for onus, if it's really out of his control, he will not be responsible. If it's somewhat within his control, he's responsible. So how do we look at this? Does he have an obligation to watch ab initio? Does he have liability after the fact to pay, or both? The Chasam Sofer argues that both are his responsibility. A, to whatever degree we hold him responsible, he has to do it up front. And B, he says, if he doesn't do it, he will be liable. That's how he understands these psukim about Yaakov Avinu. The psukim say, Yaakov initially says, whatever was missing, I paid for. And then he says, I stayed up all night watching the sheep. I mean, once Yaakov is responsible for any sheep that go missing, staying up at night is for his own benefit, not Lavan's. Lavan's going to be made whole either way. Lavan's going to get either his sheep back or compensation. So what does Lavan gain by Yaakov staying up all night? Chasam Sofer explains that no, Yaakov had a dual responsibility. First of all, don't tell me you'll send me a check later. I want you to stay up all night watching my sheep. And B, if you don't, or even if you do and something goes wrong, you're going to have to pay me for the sheep. But both are included in your responsibility. You have to A, up front, do it. And B, you're going to be responsible if you don't. This kind of rule applies in other areas of Chashon Mishpat too. For example, the laws of Shechenim, of neighbors, which we touched on for Parshas Chayesara. So one of the halachas discussed there is when you install an oven in your home, different types of furnaces, ovens, the oven has to be basically up to code, the code established by halacha or the law or both, that otherwise the neighbors can object, you're going to burn down the house and take my house with it. Your house is your business, but if you start a fire, my house is in danger too. So A, you have to construct the oven according to code. B, if you don't, you're going to have to pay for any fire damage. Now, the fact that you're willing to pay and you're even willing to put money up in escrow up front doesn't exempt you from constructing the oven according to code. And everybody can say, I like my house. I like my house currently the way it is. I don't want to check and have to rebuild the house. I want the thing up front. So you have to A, be careful not to be reckless. And B, if you are, you pay me. And that's basically the halacha of a shomer too. He has to, A, up front, be careful and take proper care of the property. B, ex post facto, if something goes wrong, he's going to be liable. But here we have a fascinating halachic debate among the poskim. A shomer sachar gets paid. He gets paid whatever the fee was. In Lavan's case, he got a percentage of the sheep, the colored sheep, whatever it was. What is that payment for? Is that payment as an employee, paying him for the service he's rendering? Is that payment as you would pay an insurer, payment for liability, or some kind of hybrid payment for both? The poskim discuss two major, what we call nafkaminas, two major cases which illustrate the difference. One case is, let's say the shomer decides, contrary to halacha, he's taking the day off. He's going to go out drinking with his buddies. He's going to leave the animals in the field. You know, we don't let him do that, but he did. And he got lucky. Nothing happened. Fortunately, nothing happened that day. All the animals came home safe and sound. So he comes to his employer and says, okay, $100 a day, that's our rate, please pay me $100. The employer says, I saw you goofing off all day. You didn't do any work for me, why should I pay you? You hire a worker to paint your house, he doesn't paint it, he doesn't get paid. So the boss says, I'm not gonna pay, you didn't do any work. The employee says, well, had the animals gone missing, you would have asked me for the $1,000 that they cost. I was on the hook for that. I accepted liability. I basically was committing myself to insure your animals against loss. Pay me the premium. You know, the fact that nothing happened, you owe me for my assumption of liability. So here the question is, conceptually, the easiest way to conceive of the question is, what are you paying for? Are you paying for the service as an employee, in which case he gets nothing? Are you paying for his insurance, for his assumption of liability, in which case he is entitled to get paid? Another variation of the same question. Let's say he goofs off and the sheep do get stolen. The sheep do get taken away. So he's liable for the loss of the sheep. He writes a check for $1,000. Can he say though, okay, here's your $1,000, but please give me $100. Just like an insurance company, they make a payout for whatever, fire, theft, whatever it is. You still owe them the premium. You pay the premium in advance usually, but you still owe them the premium. The premium is not refundable if the house burns down. So the boss says, no, I'm paying you to work. You didn't work. So not only do you forfeit your compensation, you also have liability. So again, a similar question. Do we say the payment is for the service? Do we say the payment is for the assumption of liability? Do we say some kind of hybrid, the payment is for both? And this is a matter of some dispute some dispute among the poskim. You see Rabbi Kivager, number 6, Maral Diskin, number 7, many other achronim debate this point about whether he's entitled to payment. There is no clear halacha on this question. The achronim debate debate this point back and forth. Yes. So I remember once when a dentura I was involved with some years ago, where it was some kind of white collar error. There was a low level employee at some office, a secretary or someone who was not an executive or anything, made some error, some clerical error, and her error might have resulted in a fairly significant loss for the business. So the question was, again, there's a lot of discussion. It's a fairly common question in halacha, how to conceptualize the responsibility that an employee has. Shomer is one paradigm we could use. There are other paradigms involved that would be relevant to establishing her liability. But again, if we apply the letter of the halacha, she might very well, assuming there was negligence involved, it could very well be that she would be on the hook for a lot of money. It was real estate, a title or something. There could have been 6-7 figures involved in her mistake. So I remember some of my colleagues raised this point. They said even if under the halacha applied blindly would indicate that she could have unlimited liability, but the fact is someone who's not compensated well and doesn't have that much authority or responsibility and is not that involved in policy, etc., there's a kind of understanding that such an employee's liability would be limited to something, as you suggested, I think, more commensurate to her paycheck. I don't know of a direct source or parallel for that in halacha, although again, as we discussed, there is the idea of minhag and there is the idea of default assumptions, and if it could be established, I think, that in this industry, in this type of work, whatever it is, those are the expectations that people who are limited in the upside and limited in their authority and limited in their participation shouldn't have that much downside, that could control, but you'd basically have, I don't think it would be a native halachic rule, but it would have to be some kind of minhag or some kind of standard assumption being made in that area. In these cases, there was no knas. The knas
is... Even in the case of where Shulma Sakhar doesn't come in, to a certain extent, there's a shtickle shia there. Right?
Yes.
So he just pays either way. So in other words, either the animal was stolen while he did his due diligence, or the animal was stolen in a shia.
Either way, he pays the same amount. Yes, he pays compensation for the animal, nothing more.
How about if the owner says, you're going to be my...
So that's a very important question, whether a shomer pays the... Yes, yeah, that's a very important question, whether a shomer pays the value of the animal as it was when it was entrusted to his care, or the value of the animal as it was when it was stolen. I don't have my notes on that. I believe the halacha is pretty standard that he pays the value as it was when the accident happened, but I would have to review just to make sure. But I think that's the halacha. But either way, there's no kefil, no knas or anything. He pays the value either at the time of the initial shmira, or I think the halacha is at the time of the accident. So here, returning back to the question I was discussing before, the question of whether the shomer forfeits his salary or not, this touches on a very, very important, very critical question in halacha, in Chosh and Mishpat, which has ramifications literally all over the place. I saw a paper once by Rabbi Baruch Rakover, Professor Nachum Rakover's brother. He talks about the following interesting case. I don't know if this would be true under American law. He's talking about Israeli law, but he discusses the following situation. He says, personal injury. Someone injures someone else, so we know halacha says he's chayav several types of compensation. One of them is called sheves, lost wages. If you injure a person and he can't work, he's out for a week, you owe him his wages for the week. So Rabbi Rakover says, let's say his wages for the week were $1,000. He is in a 25% marginal tax bracket. That $1,000 would have only resulted in a net income to him of $750. Now he says, and again, I don't know if this is true under American law, maybe someone knows about this, but he says that in Israeli law, apparently, income is taxed at the marginal income tax rates. Compensation for injury, even if it's compensation for lost wages, is not taxed the same way. It's not taxed at all, or it's not taxed as ordinary income. I don't know what the rule is, But basically, let's assume it's not taxed at all. So if you pay him compensation for his lost wages, that'll all go straight to his pocket. There'll be no cut to the tax man. So Rakover asked, how much should you pay him? Should you pay him 1,000? Because his lost wages are 1,000 gross. Should you pay him 750? Because he only would have had net 750 after taxes. So the general question conceptually is, when you cause someone an injury and his gross loss revenue or lost asset value would have been X, but his net would have been much lower because he would have had other costs involved to realize that much, or other costs that would have come off the top, how much do you owe? Do you owe the full amount, or do you owe only what he would have had net in his bottom line? Many, many other applications of this throughout halacha. Another case involves a crop where when the crop is mature, after all costs, it's still 2 months out from maturity, and it involves more work, more agricultural work. It'll have to be trucked to market, whatever. But after when it finally gets to market, it'll bring in $1,000. But there'll be another $200 of costs that the farmer will have before he can realize his 1,000. And you damage it right now, so he won't get his 1,000, but he won't have to pay those extra 200 in costs. How much do you owe? Do you owe him 1,000? Do you owe him 800? Net or gross, essentially. So Rabbi Rakover discusses this. This is a much earlier question. It goes back to Talmudic discussions, many contradictions and distinctions. Although, as I said, there are many ramifications of this throughout halacha, it is a very unsettled matter. So, returning to our case of the Shomer, some Achronim, Marl Diskin, the Chazon Ish, they argue the question I was raising before. Let's say the question is, when the Shomer goofs off, is liable to replace the animal, does he also forfeit his compensation or not? Some Achronim argue, Marl Diskin, Chazon Ish, they say it doesn't really matter. In principle, it doesn't matter if he forfeits his compensation or not, because if he doesn't, then fine. He gets his compensation, he uses it to offset what he owes for the property. The sheep were worth 1,000, his compensation was 100. 1,000 minus 100 is 900, he pays 900. Let's say you say he does forfeit his compensation. The Achronim argue, but the fact is, even if he forfeits his compensation, he can turn around and tell the owner of the sheep, I still only caused you a net loss of $900, because had I done my job, you would have had your $1,000 sheep, but you would have had a $100 liability, my wages. So at the end of the day, even if I forfeit my compensation, the loss to you is still net only $900. So some Achronim argue that it doesn't matter whether in principle he should forfeit his compensation or not. We should argue that either way he can use his agreed upon compensation to offset the total loss, and the total loss, therefore the net loss to the owner, is still only the difference between the value of the property and his compensation. So some Achronim argue that it is really a moot point and that it doesn't really matter whether he would forfeit his compensation or not. Now, again, returning to the question, this middle ground of the Shomer Sachar, to what extent is his liability? How far does he have to go? So in the Gospel of John at the end, Jesus describes himself as being the good shepherd. I was trying to figure out, in Judaism we have the phrase, the faithful shepherd, the good shepherd. In a part of the Zohar is called the Raya Mehemna, the faithful shepherd. I don't actually know where that phrase comes from, how far back it goes. You know, a little Googling around didn't yield much. But the good shepherd anyway is in the Gospels. And Jesus claims that the good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. A hireling, he says, doesn't do that. A hireling who's owned the sheep or not, he sees the wolf coming, he leaves the sheep and flees. But the hireling, he's only a hireling, he cares not for the sheep. But the good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. Does a shomer have to give his life for the sheep? The answer is, of course, no. A shomer does not, whether he's a hired shomer or any other shomer, a hireling most certainly does not have to give his life for the sheep. And indeed, the specific question if a wolf comes for the sheep, that actually is discussed in the Mishnah. Going back to paragraph 2, the last line of number 2, the Mishnah says, Ze'ev echad eina ones. The truth is that if one wolf is coming for the sheep, you do have to try to fight off the wolf. Shnei ze'evim ones. Once there are two wolves, that is too much already. That is too hard to fight off. And that is the halacha, that one wolf you have to fight. Two wolves you don't have to fight. But saying you have to fight one wolf doesn't mean that you have to get killed to save the sheep. The assumption is that a shepherd should be able to fend off a wolf. I've never been out there battling wolves to save sheep. I don't know how practical that is or how much training you would need to successfully fight off a wolf, but the Mishnah does expect a shomer to fight off a wolf. However, the Ktos HaChoshen rules, in number 8 I have it, the Ktos HaChoshen, this is at the end of a longer discussion, But he argues that there's a difference here, but the mission doesn't distinguish here clearly between a shomer chinam and a shomer sachar, between an unpaid and a paid guardian. The Ksos HaChoshen, though, establishes a major rule. He says that in general, a shomer chinam is not obligated to take any loss or any damage to save the property in his charge. A shomer sachar is. So he says a wolf, which will often involve some possibility of injury, not death maybe, but injury at least. He says a shomer chinam certainly... since this involves some level of risk or some minor danger, if not danger of life, of getting bitten or whatever, a shomer chinam would not actually have to fight off the wolf. The mission is only talking about a shomer sachar. The shomer sachar is obligated to fight off the wolf, even at some risk of danger to himself. Again, not danger of life. You know, taking care of someone's property is not yahari val yavar. You certainly aren't expected to give up your life to save sheep. But at the possibility of some level of danger or damage that a shomer sachar is obligated to, but a shomer chinam is not. The case that Ksos is discussing is actually an interesting case. It goes back to the Rama in a responsum, a tshuva the Rama wrote. The question was, someone had property entrusted to his care. There was a fire in his home. He only had time to save some property. He had to choose between his own property or the stuff he was watching for somebody else. He chose to save his own property, and the property, the bailment, the stuff entrusted to him, was damaged and destroyed in the fire. So the question basically was, does a shomer have to keep watching, again, not giving up his life, but does a shomer have to keep watching at the expense of his own property? So this became a major dispute among the Achronim, and the Ksos is defending the position adopted by many Achronim that the Shomer would be obligated to give up, take a Shomer, if he's a Shomer Sachar, if he's getting paid, would be obligated to take some kind of financial hit, would be obligated to give up his own property to save the property that he's watching. However, a Shomer Chinam would not. That's the opinion of the Ksos, and that's why he says with the wolves too, same idea, you're obligated to assume some level of wolf bite. If you're a shomer sachar, you are not obligated to if you are only a shomer chinam. Now, the truth is, even though I've been saying that saving somebody's sheep is not yahari val yavar, you don't have to give up your life for it, the matter is not actually so simple. There is a Talmudic rule that says, Osir lahatzlat of imam and chavero. It is prohibited to save one's life at the expense of one's neighbor's property. What does that mean, osir? So the Talmud actually gives a story. It interprets some verses in the Sefer Shmuel. It says that David and his men were campaigning against the Plishtim. Plishtim were using some fields, some agriculture, as cover to hide an ambush, whatever it was they were doing. David and his men wanted to burn out the fields to save themselves, to destroy the Plishtim, to save the Jews. So they asked a question, but these fields were private property. They were owned by private citizens. David asked the Sanhedrin, they asked the Sanhedrin, can I save myself? Can we save ourselves at the expense of private property? And the answer was no. Osir lahatzel atzmo and chavero. However, melech paritz geder, as a king, you have special rights, and so on. Now again, our interest here is not in whether the historicity of the story, or whether it's a mashal of some sort, but the halacha is discussed by all the poskim. There is a rule, osir lahatzel atzmo and chavero. However, the mainstream approach is, it doesn't actually mean osir. It doesn't mean a person is expected to die because someone else's property is sacrosanct. It means that if you damage someone else's property to save your life, you have to pay for it. If you're drowning and if you're in a burning house and you have to break the guy's window to get out, so you pay him for the window. You're allowed to do it, but pay him for it. If the house were to burn down anyway, the window's not going to last. You don't have to pay, maybe. But if you damage someone's property to get away from a life-threatening danger, you can do it, but you have to pay for it. So there actually is some very interesting discussion in the cases of Shomer. We're not going to have time to fully discuss this, but there actually are certain scenarios where the poskim seem to argue that even if the reason that you let down, that you didn't save the property of the Shomer, is because you're in danger of your life, some poskim actually apply the rule of Osir lahatzlatim omen chavero. For example, there's a tshuva in the Binyamin Zev. He deals with a case, the facts are not entirely clear, but it sounds that what was happening was somebody was watching someone's property in his home, and armed robbers broke in and they stole the property. Subsequently, when the owner of the property took him to court, took him to Beis Din, he says, why didn't you sound the alarm? There were police in the streets. This is 16th century. He said, you could have called for help. So he says, the reason I didn't do that was because these guys had knives, and they told me that if you make a sound, we'll cut your throat. So the Binyamin Zev actually rules that he's chayav to pay for the loss of the property, because this falls under the category in certain cases of asur lahatzlas of amon chavera. Now, obviously, I think it goes without saying, if they would have cut his throat before he can get the alarm out, then we don't expect him to do that, because that would just make no sense at all. I mean, why try if they're going to stop you before? I guess the assumption is he could have possibly called out. They would have then killed him and run before they had a chance to pilfer the goods. So the question is he supposed to do that? So again, l'chatchila, nobody's going to say, I mean, maybe not nobody, but l'chatchila, the mainstream approach is to say that no, you are not supposed to get yourself killed to save somebody's property. However, this might fall into the category of asur lahatzlas v'mamon chavero, and that everyone agrees if an armed robber comes and says, give me that property, then you give it to him. And that's not your responsibility as a shomer. When they come to steal his property, then you give it up. The case of Binyamin Zev apparently was different because they weren't actually coming for the property that you were securing. They were coming for your property. So you just, once they were there, they stole his property too. It's a more complicated case. But in general, if the armed robbers actually come and say, give us the property that you're watching, then that's clear. That's a clear Talmudic ruling numerous times that you give it to them and you're off the hook, even a shomer sachar. However, in a case where they were not coming for the stolen property, you just found yourself in danger for some reason. You found yourself in danger, and you, the only way to save yourself was by endangering the property. There's a tshuva in the Maritz Alon. He had a case where somebody was carrying a sack of flour for someone from city to city on an animal of some sort. He was accosted along the way by somebody who wanted to kill him, molest him, something. His life was in danger. Nothing to do with the flour. They wanted to just beat him up for some reason. So he had to run. The only way he could run was by abandoning the flour. So the Maritz Alon rules chayav. He says that falls into the category of asur lahatzlas v'mamon chavero. It's true you had to save your life. It's true the only way you could do so is by abandoning the property. Okay, so you saved your life at the expense of someone else's property. And you're chayav for that. Because saving your life, it's true, it's very important, paramount value in Judaism, but you still have to pay for the consequences of your actions if, by saving your life, you infringe on the property rights belonging to someone else. So again, everyone agrees that the shepherd it's going to be normative halacha, the shepherd is not actually going to give up his life for the sheep. And if the armed robbers come for the sheep, there's no question he can give them the sheep. If the wolves come for the sheep and he's 10 wolves, he's not strong enough to fight them off, lions, tigers, you know, coming for the sheep, he's not strong enough to fight them off, then he's supposed to get help if he can, but if he can't, he's going to be off the hook. But there are potentially certain cases where when he winds up saving his own life indirectly at the expense of the property entrusted to his care, there will be certain cases where he may be chayev under the rule of asur lahatzlas v'mamon chavero.